Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode. I'm really excited to discuss this case with you. But before that, I don't know. I like doing weekly updates. I don't know if this is going to be a forever thing on this show. But, you know, I had a really eventful week this past week. Like, on Tuesday, it was my first class of getting my scuba certification. So we had our pool session, and that was really fun. It was stressful for me, but I don't know, last week was just stressful anyways, so so yeah, it was good. It was really cool, actually. I did it with my fiance and his little sister, and it was fun to do it with them and to be able to learn alongside with them. Yeah, we're going on a scuba trip in July, which I am so excited for. That's just, literally every time I think about it, I'm just like, I get to see sharks. And of course, it's more than just the sharks, but I love sharks. Yeah, and then on Wednesday, I had a job interview, and that was, I don't know, I always get super nervous because I have to sell myself, and I'm like, I don't know how to do that. Like, what qualities do people want? Whatever, that's just me, like, talking down on myself. Ignore that. Then I had something on Thursday with my family, and I don't know, it was okay. Friday, I had a doctor's appointment that morning, and then my best friend is getting married on the 27th next week, and so we had a bachelorette party, and that was so much fun. I was able to, like, organize that, and just being able to plan that. I like planning things. And then on Saturday, one of my friends got married, and so, we had his ceremony, his luncheon, his reception, all of that goodness on Saturday. And it was beautiful. He and his now wife looked so happy, and just, it's kind of wild. My friends are getting married. Granted, my friends have been getting married for the past couple of years, because a lot of my friends are older than me, and so, yeah. But, anywho, that was my crazy week. Yeah. Thank you for listening. And now we are going to go and look more into this case. And yes, I do know that this case is about Michael Rockefeller, but in my introduction, I'm going to be talking about his great-grandfather, John D. Rockefeller, to kind of give some background about this family. Cool. Just thought I would give you guys that kind of, like, information, so don't come at me like, I thought this was about Michael. Keep listening. It is definitely about Michael. Okay. Let us begin. So there is no secret that the Rockefellers were rich and famous, but they didn't start that way. So John D. Rockefeller was born in upstate New York in 1839. In 1863 is when he began his journey in the oil business. He invested in a Cleveland, Ohio refinery, and he established Standard Oil in 1870, which controlled about 90% of U.S. refineries or pipelines by the 1880s. Many sought to destroy this oil empire that John D. Rockefeller made for himself and his family because of the unethical practices that he used. The Standard Oil bought out rival refineries and companies that were just starting out. Standard Oil built its own barrels to store the oil and employed scientists. Because of the business's success and Rockefeller's wealth, he was a target, as all celebrities come to be, and was criticized for how he built his empire. Rockefeller wanted his children and his grandchildren to also have his entrepreneurial spirit. Yeah, it's just like, I wonder what that was like in like the 1800s, because I don't know, I need to look more into like the technology that they had back then and to be able to figure out what they had, because I'm so used to what we have nowadays, you know? And so it's just like I wonder if like the Rockefellers lived kind of like now, like in the 2000s. I wonder what would have happened then. Of course, we have a lot more movements against like climate change and everything. And so I'm sure that would be a factor. I don't know if people believed in climate change in the 1800s. I'm not sure. But I wonder, like, who were the other celebrities in the 1800s? Like, who else was so famous and had such an influence on like America? You know, I need to look in more into that because history is really cool. Fun fact, if you don't like history, then you're not looking hard enough because there is always something interesting, and typically it's something dirty, which I have a really dirty sense of humor, so that kind of works. And yeah, it's just there's so much to look for, and you will find what you're looking for. Awesome. So, you know, John D. Rockefeller wanted everybody in his family to kind of have his same drive. But however, his great grandson, Michael, was not appealed to the fame and the money that his family had. Michael Rockefeller was born on May 18th of 1938 to his parents, Nelson and Mary. I believe it's Nelson and Mary because it also mentioned that Michael has a twin sister named Mary, and I'm like, so either. Well, like, so she was named after her mother, or what? I don't know. I'm just kind of confused on that aspect, but that's not uncommon, especially, I believe, back then. That was definitely a thing. So, yeah, I don't know. I'll bring up Nelson and Mary again. Okay. So, Michael was not the youngest, but he was Nelson's fifth child. And when Michael was a teenager, Nelson Rockefeller founded the Museum of Primitive Art. Michael was fascinated by traveling, other cultures, and art. He fell in love with what he saw at the museum. Michael wanted to appease his father, and so he attended Harvard University and studied history and economics. At Harvard, he met Robert Gardner. Robert was a filmmaker and started working on his new project called Dead Birds, which was a documentary. Closely after Michael graduated, Michael at this point was torn. He knew his father wanted his son to be like him, to pursue a career in banking or finances, and make his passion a hobby. But for Michael, it was kind of difficult because he wanted to live his own life. You know, as most college students and teenagers start to realize, like, hey, this is my life. I get to do what I want to do. And a majority of the time, teenagers and young adults, they think these things, but then they kind of like don't realize the consequences. And granted, we as a society tend to forget that consequences can either mean good things or bad things. It's not just bad things, because sometimes when we make a choice, good things happen. And that's wonderful. That's why we make choices, so that it can be good. But yeah, a lot of, I don't know, specifically like parents, they want you to do what they want you to do because they have more experience. But the thing is, it's our life, and in order for us to make our own decisions and to learn and grow, we need to make our own decisions. Yes, guidance is wonderful, but like in this case with Michael, he wanted to tread his own path. And if he didn't tread his own path, then he wouldn't have lived his happy life. Granted, in the end, that's kind of what I don't know. So this case is like unsolved, but There are so many different theories. He's probably dead. Obviously, like, he's dead by now because it's 2022. And yeah, whatever. Sorry, I'm just kind of rambling, kind of like getting wishy-washy. But yeah, with Michael, inevitably in the end, following his passion is kind of what, like, got him killed. But he lived a happy life. I like to say that because he did. He learned so much. Well, you know, I'll just continue on with the story and you'll get to find out why. So, he had experiences traveling because of his father's work. Michael stopped and worked at a ranch in Venezuela for a summer, and he visited Japan in 1957. He'd also been surrounded by art, specifically primitive art. So growing up, Nelson Rockefeller made it a point to teach his children about his hobbies, which was art. Nelson took his kids to art dealers and rearranged his art, and his kids enjoyed watching their father at work. And I guess it's kind of like beautiful that Michael had similar, like, he enjoyed art kind of like his father did, except his father only pursued art in like as a hobby, while Michael wanted to pursue it as a career and inevitably like his lifestyle. His life, he just wanted to make art. That's kind of beautiful. The world needs more artists, and yeah, so like, make art. Thank you. Okay, so back to Robert Gardner, the filmmaker friend. He offered a job to Michael, and they would have to travel to then Dutch New Guinea or Netherlands New Guinea, and this opportunity was a dream come true for Michael. The history, the travel, how could he say no? So Michael signed on as a sound engineer for the documentary. And at this time, his father also named him a trustee of the Museum of Primitive Art. This opportunity was perfect for Michael. He knew he had to work hard to make his father proud, so he planned on studying more of the art of the people there, and eventually hoped to bring back what he had found. And the people that they would be visiting, they were the Asmat tribe. There, the lands were perfect and provided everything and anything you could possibly need for this tribe. There were rivers used kind of like modern day freeways, and in these rivers were 15 foot long crocodiles. My mom is thinking right now, nope, that is not perfect. Same mom. So crocodiles and alligators are really scary. I'll side with her on this. The jungles held pigs, couscous, and cassowary? Yeah, I did not pronounce that right. But you know, I don't know how to pronounce things, so forgive me. Thank you. So the Asmat tribe also has its secrets, spirits, laws, and customs, kind of like all nations do. They lived as hunter-gatherers and produced beautiful carvings. In the 1950s, some Dutch missionaries and government officials started the process of pacifying the Asmat, otherwise known as quelling the anger or agitation, or using or threatening force to bring peace to a nation or a country. You know, this happens in history a lot with people who are not white, and it's just very frustrating. So, yeah, I just... ugh. Whatever, that will be a rant for another day. So, obviously, within the tribe, there were different villages. And by 1961, the intervillage warfare and headhunting continued. I wonder if Michael and, I believe his name is Robert, I don't know. Sorry, Robert, the filmmaker, that I got your name wrong, probably. I'm not sure. But, like, I wonder if they knew that headhunting was a thing. They probably did, because they are well-educated and Harvard graduates. But, like, I don't know if I would travel somewhere where they cut off your heads. I wonder what they were thinking, but whatever. You know, maybe they thought this is an adventure. And plus, it was, like, the headhunting was mainly just between the different villages of the Azmat tribes. And so maybe they thought, you know, we're safe. We got this. Which is understandable. You know, I would probably be thinking that as well. And so many Azmat had never seen a Westerner or like a white person. So Michael wrote, "Now this is wild and somehow more remote country than what I have ever seen before." Which is kind of like crazy to think, because I remember reading in an article that there wasn't like a cell tower except in one of the big cities. I believe that big city is Agat. And then just they didn't have vehicles. Like, I don't know, they didn't have cars there. I think this is me trying to remember reading this article. And then there was only one airstrip, which was also near the big city, Agat. Which is kind of crazy to think, like, they didn't have that modern technology, like, the entire world was seeing, and it was, like, their own little kind of world within, like, this big world. I wonder what the people thought. And so, the world of the Azmat was sort of a mirror image of the West, according to Carl Hoffman. So Carl Hoffman was actually one of the people who wrote a book about the Azmat, and the book that he wrote is called Savage Harvest: A Tale of Cannibals, Colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's Tragic Quest for Primitive Art. So I did not have the time to read this book, but you know, that this sounds really interesting. I like learning more about, like, I don't know, I just like learning. So if any of you have read the book, please make sure to comment on this week's post on Instagram or Facebook. We have Facebook, guys. I know, we're moving up in the world. Yeah, so please follow us at secondary accounts, either on Instagram or Facebook. Yeah, thank you. Sorry for that kind of plug. But yeah, if any of you have read that book or are curious about that book, I will find like a link to it on Amazon or whatnot, and yeah, post it on my story or something. Cool. Now let's go back to what Carl Hoffman said about the Azmat tribe. So he said, in some areas, men had sex with each other. They occasionally shared wives. In bonding rituals, they sometimes drank one another's urine. They killed their neighbors and they hunted human heads and ate human flesh, end quote. That's just, like, kind of a lot to take in. Not the first part, because, like, I don't know, in 2022, like, people, I don't know, I don't want to, like, go into this conversation right now. But, like, it's a very important conversation to have, so I will go into it, because, there is, like, we have the LGBTQ+ community, and it's very real, you know? Like, it's not fake. It's not just a phase, you know, whatever. It's, like, it's a real thing. People, I don't really care, like, if people have sex with the same gender, with the opposite gender, as long as both are consenting adults. Adults is the main fact, and consent, because both are very important. And so, yes, have consent, be an adult, know what you're getting into, and do whatever, do whoever. Thank you for my TED talk today. And so, moving on about the Azmat tribe. Wait, no, going back. They drank one another's urine. I'm like, how clear is their urine? Is it dark? Is it dark pee? Ew. I just think that's so disgusting. I don't know about you guys. I hope you guys think it's disgusting as well. I'm not meaning to try and, like, be rude to this tribe or anything. It's just very different, you know? And so, I'm not trying to be offensive. I just, it's different. And like in the in modern times that we live in, drinking pee is not the best for you. So I've heard. I've never drank pee before. Yeah. All right. And so the Azmat lived in a world of spirits. And spirits were everywhere, and every villager could see and talk to them. Safan, I apologize if I'm pronouncing this wrong. Safan was the kingdom of the ancestors across the seas. All were very real and held equal importance. This life, the in-between, and the Safan. So death was brought to pass by the spirits. Like, let's say if somebody was sick, it was because some spirits were jealous of the living, and they brought disease. Life and death balanced each other out. In order to keep sickness and death in check, sacred feasts, ceremonies, and reciprocal violence would chase the ancestors back to Safan. And as I mentioned earlier, the Azmat created and crafted without stone, which, like, dang, that's really cool. They made shields, drums, paddles, canoes, and, again, this is a word which I will say a lot, but I will mispronounce a lot. The Bij, the B-I-S-J, poles showed men being interwoven with mantises and crocodiles and were 20 feet high. Mantises and crocodiles are known for beheading things. Keep this in mind. These carvings were memorials of the dead and were reminders of their memory, but also gave the Azmat the responsibility to avenge their dead. One of the Azmat creation myths taught the men how to headhunt and to butcher the body. A generalized story of the creation is this. The first brothers of the world exist. The older brother persuades the younger into killing him and placing his head onto the groin of a young man. The skull from the dead older brother nourishes the initiate's growth. So that's the generalized creation myth story that the Azmat tribe believes. And so once the Bij, I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm so sorry. Once that pull was finished, the raids began. Revenge and balance. New heads were obtained. I'm sure this was the initiation for the boys to turn into men, you know, like as most cultures do. And the blood of the victims were rubbed into the pole. And after this process, the spirit was happy and satisfied. And in order to celebrate, the villagers had sex and moved the poles to rot into the sago fields. This would complete the cycle. I'm not sure if sex was mandatory for completing the cycle. Maybe they only had sex for celebration, and I'm not even sure if the women were involved in this process. Knowing how women have generally been treated in history, I'm assuming it's the men in charge of this cycle. So, kind of like how Carl Hoffman brought up before, it was like the men having sex with each other, you know? And so I just think that's it's an interesting celebration process. And so the Azmat claimed that anything they couldn't understand came from the spirit world. They believed that since the white man came across the sea, they must be super beings, since they came from the place that the spirits lived. And while working on the documentary, Michael fell in love with the culture of the Azmat. He conducted several expeditions, there we go, to collect their art to bring it back to his father's museum in New York, since Michael was still a trustee of the Museum of Primitive Art. Michael took note of his plans, his trips, and as the days he spent in the Azmat tribe grew, the seriousness of bringing back their art grew as well. He had plans to write books and wanted to collect as much of their art as he could. Michael and his traveling party included Gerbrands and Renee Wassing, as well as others. When Michael and Wassing returned to Azmat in October of 1961 on one of their expeditions, he managed to get a Dutch police officer to sell his homemade catamaran to him. I don't know if I'd want a homemade catamaran, but then granted, I don't know if in that tribe, like in this region of the world, if that was the only option available. Probably. But after Michael got the catamaran, he put axes, fishing hooks, and line, cloth, and tobacco to barter with the Azmat. The Azmat had become addicted to tobacco, so Michael knew what to do in order to get what he wanted. He was a businessman, fulfilling his own dreams while still supporting his father. So, yeah, Michael planned to barter with the Azmat in order to get these poles. You guys know which poles I'm talking about. And all of their, like, most of their carvings, most of their work, because he wanted it. So Michael, Wasing, and two Azmat teens ventured to 13 different villages over the span of 3 weeks. That's kind of crazy. Like, I wonder how, like, I wonder what that was like. And so Michael was enthralled by his findings, specifically the poles. He stated, "This was one kind of subject that seemed to me inviolate for the encroachment of Western commercialism upon Azmat art," unquote. And that's just kind of a beautiful quote. The first couple of times I read it, I was like, wait, what? I need to reread this. So for those of you who are like me, let me reread it for you. Quote, "This was one kind of object that seemed to me inviolate for the encroachment of Western commercialism upon Azmat art," unquote. So the first four poles Michael bought are in the Michael C. Rockefeller wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, which is really cool. Like, oh, his work is still there, you know, as it should, because he gave his life for this work. So in mid-November of, I believe, still 1961, Michael and his party planned on riding down the Arafura Sea coast to go to Southern Azmat, so Michael could rendezvous with Cornelius von Kessel, a single priest in an unacculturated and wild area, as many said. As the party crossed the mouth of the Betj River, B-E-T-S-J, the winds and the waters fought. And so this caused the waves to heave, and eventually their catamaran capsized. The Azmat teenagers knew the river well since, you know, they were born here, they lived by the water, and so they swam for land, and they made it. Because they left Michael and Wasing to cling to the hull of the boat. So the teens left to find help, which is wonderful, you know? Like, most teenagers would be like, eh, not my circus, not my monkey. And so the Dutch colonial government officials were fighting the clock to find ships. Anything, like helicopters, airplanes, to search for Michael and Wasing. And eventually, the night turned to day, and the day was November 19th. Michael was worried that the hull would eventually drift out to sea, and if that happened, there would be absolutely no hope. Michael then took off all of his clothes except his underwear, tied empty cans to his belt to help with his buoyancy, then he jumped off, or let go, of the hull. Since Michael either jumped off or let go of the hull of the boat, he swam. He assumed it would be about a 3 to 10 mile swim to the shore. And that afternoon, Wasing was spot from the air and she was rescued the next morning. Michael was nowhere to be found. His parents, Nelson and Mary, sent reporters out there to try and help locate their son. However, their reporters didn't do much except occasionally hold press conferences that contained no news. All anyone could do was wait. The Dutch minister told the New York Times on November 24th, there is no longer any hope of finding Michael Rockefeller alive. On November 28th, Nelson and Mary flew home. 2 weeks after that, the Dutch called off the search. We don't know what exactly happened to Michael, but there are some theories. So, here is one theory. he was eaten by cannibals. So in 1958, a Dutch governor, Max Loper, again, I apologize for my pronunciation, he killed 5 Asmat tribe members. Max shared his hopes that this would cause a stop to headhunting. No, but the Asmat promised revenge to the white tribes, since there were not a lot of white people that met with the Asmat. They waited. So in November of 1961, the Asmat saw Michael swimming to shore, and they knew that Michael looked tired. So they pulled him to shore and killed him with their spears. Michael's head was cut off. They cooked it and ate his brain. His entrails were removed, his arms and legs were thrown into the fire, and his bones were used to make religious icons, daggers, and other fishing spears. So that's one theory. There are other ideas that he was still, that he was eaten by crocodiles, which is very plausible, you know? Like, I think that's really possible. That he ran off to live with the Asmat since he didn't enjoy the extravagant life that his family had back in New York. Or, like I mentioned before, he was eaten by cannibals. So, in 1964, it was declared that Michael died by drowning. Though his body was still not found, this seems to be the most plausible, you know? But it's boring. The news doesn't like boring, and frankly, neither do I. Because, like, there are so many different opportunities that could be happening here, and saying that he drowned? But, you know, maybe they just said he drowned, because what if it was a cover-up? Dun dun dun! A cover-up! Okay, so let me tell you about it. Let me tell you about this conspiracy theory. So the Dutch had already given half of their island to Indonesia. And because of this, the Dutch didn't really have as much power as they're used to. And so if Michael was killed and eaten by cannibals, the government's legitimacy and authority of the region would be questioned. So one journalist in 1969 traveled to a village called Oostjenep. Yeah, we'll work with that. And he learned of the 1958 massacre the Asmat leaders committed by the Dutch, that story that I shared previously. So an American anthropologist named Tobias Schneebaum, decades after the fact, met with the same village that the journalist did. And there, the villagers claimed to having killed and eaten Michael. So remember that priest Cornelius von Kessel that I mentioned earlier? The one that Michael was going to rendezvous with? Well, he knew the Asmat tribe pretty well, and assisted in the search for Michael. Then Cornelius claimed to have seen tibias and femurs decorating the spears of tribesmen. That he shared that, like, they probably were Michael's. I don't know how close this priest and Michael were. I don't know. So, those are the theories that Michael was eaten by people, by crocodiles, by the ocean itself. So it's just very interesting. This case was recommended to me by my fiancé, Brandon. Shout out to you, Brandon. I love getting, like, case recommendations, so please send me all of your case recommendations, people. I will gladly look into them. And, you know, I'm sure I'll use them in future episodes. So, this is the case of Michael Rockefeller, the famous great-grandson. And honestly, that entire family is famous, so, like, good job, guys. Good for you. And he went missing, and he died for his passion. You know, what if he did live among the Asmat? Like, where would he hide, you know? Like, what if he fell in love and, like, had his own little family there? Like, or what if crocodiles ate him? What if people ate him? I wonder. That's just, like, ugh. I don't ever want to eat people. Anywho, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Yeah, I guess join us next week. I don't know which case we're working on next week, but anywho, I like to surprise you guys. Yeah. So, I hope hope you guys have a wonderful week this week. And if you don't, I'm sorry. I've been there. You know, it happens. And there will always be better weeks. And so, thank you guys again for listening to Secondary Accounts. Yeah, go check us out on Instagram or Facebook at Secondary Accounts. Follow us there for pictures of the case, pictures of either the victims or who the story is about. So you will see pictures of the Azmet tribe of Michael Rockefeller. And yeah. So I'll see you guys next week. Bye.